Ended up talking about just some of the general principles of evolution. Today what we want to do is start talking about some of the lines of evidence for evolution. The theory of evolution, as we were talking about it last week, I think one of you asked the question, can you prove evolution to be true? Well, the answer is of course, in science we can't really prove anything to be true, but it hasn't been proven false yet, okay? And so the more lines of evidence that we get for the theory of evolution, I guess the more true it becomes, I guess you could say. But the idea of evolution is very important in biology. And what we talk about in biology is we'll talk about evolutionary trends and how some organisms are more closely related to each other than maybe to other organisms. And that all has to do with evolution. One key line of evidence for evolution is the use of what we call comparative anatomy. Anatomy is the study of the structure of organisms. And so one thing that we can look at is we can look at anatomical structures between organisms. And many organisms have what we call homologous structures. Homologous structures are structures that are very similar in different organisms and probably came from a common ancestor. For example, if we look at the arms of a human, dolphin, bat, and a bird, if you look at the human and dolphin, they have almost the exact same bones in their arm. Okay. The same thing is true with the bat. So those three organisms, the bones are almost identical in the arm. So they probably evolved from a common ancestor. If we look at the bones of a bird wing, we can actually see that it's a little bit different, but very similar. So they probably had a common ancestor at some point in their evolutionary past, and that's what we would call a homologous characteristic. Okay. This picture just shows again some leg structures. That's one of the structures that's commonly used. However, just because an organism has a particular structure in its body doesn't mean that they always have a common ancestor. For example, we can look at the wing of a bird versus something like a dragonfly. Both wings have a similar function, right? They're to help the organism to fly. But these organisms probably do not have a common ancestor, and so we call these traits analogous traits. Analogous traits are traits that have a similar function, but probably came from different ancestors, or in other words, they probably evolved these structures independently of one another. Okay? Any questions about that? Another anatomical structure that we look at is what we call vestigial structures. Vestigial structures are structures that probably once in the evolutionary past were useful to the organism, but because of the way that they've, I guess you could say, chosen to live their life over long periods of time, those structures may not be useful in today's animal. This picture is actually showing you the pelvic bones of a blue whale. The pelvic bones of a blue whale are about that big. Now you all know that blue whales are what? The largest mammal on Earth, right? Okay. Do you all of you know what a pelvis is used for? What's your pelvis? It's to what?
Isn't it to walk?
Yeah, it's to give you support so you can walk, right? Okay. And so all land mammals actually have a fairly large pelvis, fairly strong pelvis. In the whales, their pelvis is basically what we would call a vestigial structure. It probably once was useful, but it is no longer useful. And so if we look at the blue whale, we could probably safely say that in its evolutionary past, it had an ancestor that was on land. Okay. Why else would it have those pelvic bones that are not used for anything else? Okay. Another example of a vestigial structure in our body, how many of you have heard of your appendix before? Okay, how many of you have had it out? A few of you? Okay. It's not fun to have it out, right? You get appendicitis. So what's the use of your appendix? Those of you that have it out, do you have it? Does it cause you any problems? No?
Don't they think it was used for like when we ate rocks and stuff?
Yeah, actually, really close to that. Not rocks, but grass. Okay. We see very similar structure. The appendix is located about right here in your abdomen. Okay. And that's where the large intestine and the small intestine meet. Okay, so it's located right at the junction of the large and the small intestine. We see very similar structures to our appendix in a horse and in rabbits. Okay, it's what we call a cecum, right? And this cecum, it's actually a fairly large structure in horses and rabbits, and it has lots of bacteria in it. And what those bacteria do is they help to break down the structural components of cellulose. I think we mentioned this before, that our digestive system, we can't break down plant material very well, right? Because cellulose is too complex for our digestive system to break down. Well, of course, rabbits and horses eat plant material, right? And so they actually break down that plant material using their cecum. So probably at one point in our evolutionary past, we were herbivores. Okay, does that make sense to everybody? But now we have this structure. I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's interesting that we would have a structure that has essentially no function, right? It's just a vestigial structure that's there. And it's probably because at one point we were herbivorous as human beings. Okay? Any questions about vestigial structures? Okay. Another line of evidence for evolution, I don't have any pictures here, is the fossil record. We can actually see advances or changes occurring in organisms through the fossil record, which indicates to us that there probably is some sort of evolution occurring. I think, this is my own personal opinion, one of the best lines of evidence for evolution is what we call comparative embryology. This is when we look at embryos, and look at how embryos are similar and how they are different. Okay, so what we have here is we have a number of showing drawings of a number of different types of embryos, anywhere from a human to a fish here. Notice that in the first stage of development, I think if your grade depended on telling me the difference between all of these different embryos, you'd be what? You'd be pretty much in trouble, right? You'd have a 1 in whatever, how many there is there, 8 or 9 chance of getting a good grade, right? And that's really because there's not a lot of differences between a fish's embryo very early on in development and a human embryo very early on in development, okay? What happens kind of in this next stage of development, you'll notice that some of the embryos change quite drastically, or at least they're a lot different than other embryos, right? Okay, so in the second stage here, we can probably tell something here that the fish and the salamander are probably more closely related to one another because of the way that their embryo forms than they are to a human. Okay, the human and the rabbit and the cow and the pig here, you really can't tell the difference between those. And so these organisms are probably more closely related to one another than they are to a chicken and a tortoise here. Okay, notice they're very similar. Now in the next stage of development, notice this. If you look at the rabbit, cow, and pig, there is very little difference even very late in development. Does that make sense? And so they're probably more closely related to each other. Any questions about that? Yeah.
How is it that the pig embryo is bigger than the cow embryo, but then, like, when they're full grown, the cow is a lot bigger than the pig?
It's not always necessarily bigger. It's just kind of depicting it here as bigger. They actually grow faster. That's maybe the answer. They have a shorter gestational period. Okay. So, for example, if you were to compare them to humans, actually, if we were to put all of these in the same time frame, okay, they're not all in the same time frame here, But if we were to put them in terms of days of gestation type of a thing, the human embryo would probably be the smallest because it grows the slowest. Does that make sense? So, usually larger animals, their embryos grow slower, takes longer for them to grow than smaller organisms. That's generally true, not always, but... Any questions about comparative embryology? Another line of evidence that indicates to us that evolution does occur is something that we call artificial selection. In other words, we as humans can cause evolution to occur many times on a small scale and sometimes even on a large scale. Okay? A couple of examples that I'll give to you. All of the domesticated dogs, how do we get a new breed of dog? Yeah, actually we have selected for them, and for example, you'll hear about new breeds that come along every so often. Really, what does a new breed mean? It's just something that's different about the dog, for example, a toy poodle versus a large poodle type of a thing. The way that they got the toy poodle was they probably selected for some midget large poodles, okay, and then just started crossing the midgets, so to speak, and then out of that group they got the midgets, and pretty soon you got a breed of dog that's much smaller. Okay. Another example of artificial selection, or at least not artificial selection. Selection by human beings of different types of organisms is racehorses. Racehorses are much faster today than they were 100 years ago. Okay, and basically, how do they get faster? Well, you only allow the fastest horses to breed. In fact, most of the racehorses in the United States actually, well, let's just say in the United States, actually have common ancestors. They're all close relatives of one another. Did you know that? Because what they did with, what they'll do is if you have a really fast racehorse and it's a male, they'll milk that racehorse, basically collect its sperm, and then they'll artificially inseminate many, many females with that sperm. Okay. Another example of this, this selection pressure that's exerted by humans is with corn. If you, we actually can go back and look at what corn was like when the ancient Puebloans or Anasazi down in Mesa Verde were around and in southern Utah. They actually would grow corn that was that had ears about this long, about that big around. You might have seen some of them before in historical displays. That's nothing like the corn we have today, right? Most ears are, you know, at least this long and really nice, large ears. Also, the stature of the plant is very different. In the native corn, it only grows about this tall from the bench up, okay? And it has leaves that are kind of droopy. Whereas today's corn, you know, it's taller than me and the leaves are all like this, right? And the corn plant that you would see in your garden today. And so actually we have selected for certain characteristics in corn over a long period of time, and now our corn plants are very different from what they once were, okay? And actually if you try and cross the two corn plants, the corn plant that we have commonly today, if you cross it with a kind of the old native corn, they won't even cross. They're completely different species now, okay? Any questions about that? Okay. One of the main ways in which evolution occurs is through a process that we call natural selection. Natural selection is non-random survival and reproduction of genotypes from one generation to the next. Okay. What this tells us is that if mating occurs randomly, evolution should not occur. Okay. For example, if we were to kind of create a hypothetical situation let's say that there was some disaster out in the outside world, and the only people that survived were the people in this room. Okay, that's all that survived. And so we decided as a group that we didn't want evolution to occur. Okay, what we could do is we would put all the guys' names in one hat and all the girls' names in another hat and randomly select. And if our children did that, and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren, you could come back into the population 100 years from now, and the people would look very, very similar to what you guys look like today. Okay. However, that probably wouldn't happen, right? What would happen is there may be some ladies in here that are a little bit more attractive to more of the guys, or vice versa. And so what would end up happening is in a 4 or 5 generations, we may have a much taller or much shorter population than we do today, just one trait. Okay. So natural selection occurs when there's non-random mating. In other words, sometimes natural selection is kind of the common terminology to describe natural selection. You've probably heard before, survival of the fittest. You ever heard that? And actually, that's kind of a misnomer, I guess you could say. It's not really a true statement, because not only do animals need to survive, or plants, not only do organisms need to survive, but they also need to what? They also need to be able to pass their genes onto future generations. For example, if we were the only people left on Earth, there may be some people in here that never ever produced offspring, right? Okay, they can still survive, but they have to be able to produce their offspring in the next generation. In other words, which organisms are going to pass their genes on to future generations? And this is the idea that Darwin brought forth, was the idea of natural selection. And so what he was saying is that some organisms are going to be selected for in a population, other organisms are going to be selected against in a population. And if we select for a certain group of organisms, then over time there's going to be change in the gene pool of the population, or evolution is going to occur. Okay. What I want to talk a little bit about are a couple of different types of selection pressure that can occur within a population. Before we do that, let me just give you this example of this picture here. And a good example of natural selection are roaches and roach motels. We don't have a lot of cockroaches around here, but in some places there are quite a few cockroaches. And if you had a roach motel, if a bunch of roaches go through the roach motel, what happens is most of them are going to die. Which roaches are not going to die?
Those that are immune.
Yeah, those that are immune to whatever insecticide is being used. And so in the next generation, what's going to happen?
They're all going to be immune.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot more, maybe not all of them, but a lot more of them are going to be immune. And pretty soon you're going to end up with what we would call a superbug. Okay? That's kind of what's happening with bacteria as well. You've all heard that if you don't take your full antibiotic regimen, that you're going to what? Get a resistant strain of bacteria. Okay, and that's because those resistant bacteria are the ones that survive in your body, and then over time you get more and more of those resistant bacteria. This principle of natural selection is if you're a farmer, you need to understand this. Most farmers use herbicides, which are chemicals that kill weeds, right? Okay. Do farmers use the same herbicide year after year, do you think?
No.
No, why not?
They get resistant weeds.
Yeah, you get super weeds, right? And so what farmers do is they rotate their herbicides typically, at least good farmers do. Okay. And so then they use an herbicide for a couple of years, and then they'll switch to a different type of an herbicide for a couple of years, and then switch back and forth. And that way you don't produce super weeds. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay, so let's look at a couple of different types of selection pressure. Now, in these pictures here, what they're indicating is some trait that is probably a polygenic characteristic. Remember we talked about polygenic characteristics. We said that polygenic characteristics usually Phenotypes usually come in a bell-shaped curve, okay? So we talked about one polygenic characteristic in humans, height, remember that, okay? So most characteristics are actually polygenic, and so if we use kind of the bell-shaped curve as an example, hopefully that'll help us to understand natural selection a little bit. What happens is the first type of selection pressure that we're going to talk about is directional selection. In directional selection, one extreme is selected against, or you could say it in another way, one extreme is selected for. Okay? And so what happens is if one extreme is selected for, or you could say it the other way, if this extreme over here were selected against, then what should happen is that these are the only organisms that reproduce, then in the next generation we should have a shift towards whatever characteristic that is. Okay? Let me give you a couple of hypothetical examples. All right. You probably already figured out that I like to hunt elk. I talk about it all the time. I mean, if I could hunt elk all year round and quit my job, that's what I'd do. I love that more than anything else in this world. But hunting elk, well, maybe not more than anything, but almost. But with elk have antlers, right? Okay. If you started out with a population of elk that were, you know, there was kind of a variety between bulls with smaller antlers and bulls with larger antlers, which bulls typically get to breed with the females? The larger in the group, right? And so if we have this, what this theory would say is that most of our bulls are probably average. And if you go up on the mountain today, that's still true. Average is relative, however. But there are a few larger bulls, and those are the ones that the females like to mate with. And they select against the really small guys, the guys that aren't very good looking. Okay? So in the next generation, you should get a population of larger bulls. Okay? And if that continues to happen for a long period of time, you should continually get larger and larger bulls. Okay, right? Does that kind of make sense to everybody? Now what happens most of the time with directional selection, or many times, is that at some point there's going to be a stabilizing event. In other words, we're going to shift from directional selection to stabilizing selection. And that's kind of what's happened up here on the Manti Mountain after, 12, 15 years of managing for large bulls. What happens is these smaller bulls are selected against, right, because the ladies don't like to mate with them. The largest bulls actually get selected against as well. Why?
Hunted.
Okay, one, they're hunted. That's actually not the biggest reason, though. By breeding too much? No. Not very often do animals do that. Yeah, they get caught in trees, okay, or their antlers. I don't know if any of you have ever picked up a set of elk antlers. I killed a great big bull a couple years ago and just got the head back from the taxidermist. And I mean, it takes almost two people to lift just the antlers. I'll bet they weigh probably 150 pounds, just the antlers. Okay. And so what happens is you get these antlers that weigh so much that the elk can't do what? Can't hold up its head, or they're too wide, they can't run through trees. Did I tell you about the elk I found up that was dead in between two trees up on the mountain? Actually, it was up in a place called Canal Canyon up here, and ran across an elk that was dead, standing up. Okay. And what had happened, what I think happened, of course I don't know, but what it looked to me like it had happened is this huge elk was running through the trees, and its antlers were all tangled up between these two large trees. And what I think happened is it ran into these trees and it couldn't get out, and it actually starved to death standing up. Its antlers were too big to get through the trees, right? And so there's a limit as to how big their antlers can get. And so those really large bulls get selected against, the really small bulls get selected against, and pretty soon what you end up with is you end up with a narrower range of bulls over a period of time. Okay? Any questions about that? Could give you another example that theoretically has happened over time. Let's think about pheasants, right? Pheasants, the males are very beautiful, right? They have a lot of coloration. And so females only want to mate with the good-looking guys, and so in the next generation there's more beautiful pheasants, more beautiful males, right? Again, the females only select the most beautiful guys, or most of the good-looking guys, and in the next generation we're even going to have more beautiful pheasants. So that would be directional selection. At some point, however, there's going to be a stabilizing event. The ugly guys, they're going to be selected against, right? Because they're not good looking enough. The really good looking guys, what's going to be their selection pressure? What happens if you get too colorful? Yeah, you get eaten by predators, right? The coyotes can see you, or whatever else is preying on you, okay? And so what happens is the really good looking pheasants get selected against. The really ugly ones get selected against, and pretty soon you end up with a bunch of pheasants that all look about the same. And that's really what's happened today. If you go out pheasant hunting and you get a male pheasant, I'll bet if you laid up your, if you got 10 male pheasants while you were hunting, you could lay them side by side and you would have a hard time telling which one was the more beautiful than the other one. They're all very, very similar. And so their population has been stabilized over time. Any questions about that? Now, sometimes with directional selection, what will happen is there will be a shift in the population from in one direction, and then later on the population will shift back in the opposite direction. Okay. Let me give you an example of when that might occur. Let's say our bell-shaped curve here represents drought on this end, and this is high water tolerance. Okay? So this is drought tolerant over here. What if we had a few years of a situation where we had a really wet environment? What's going to happen to this population? Okay, it's going to shift. In other words, these organisms that are drought tolerant are going to be selected against, right? So pretty soon we're going to get a population of plants that are more water tolerant than they are drought tolerant. Does that make sense? What would happen if we had a few years of drought? Then this part of the population is selected against, and what would happen to the population? It would shift back towards kind of what it used to be. Okay? And that happens in plant populations all the time, is there's directional selection, and directional selection will occur back and forth and back and forth. Any questions about that? The third type of selection pressure is what we call disruptive selection. Disruptive selection does not occur very commonly in nature. This is when the average is selected against. And generally, again, this is more of a hypothetical, theoretical type of a selective pressure than maybe it is in real life. You know of a couple of situations where this has happened in the real world, or at least theoretically where it's happened. But generally, because there are typically so many of the average, it's really hard to select enough of the average individuals to cause two new species to form. Theoretically, if disruptive selection occurred for a long period of time, you should end up with two completely separate species of organisms. Okay. Any questions about that?
What's the example?
There's actually a plant in Hawaii, and when some birds were introduced that would eat the berries on this plant, they were finches that had kind of intermediate-sized beaks. They only ate kind of the intermediate-sized berries. Okay. And then what we have now in Hawaii is one species of plant that only produces large berries and one that only produces small berries, small seeds. This may happen more than maybe what we can realize in nature, but it's really hard to, you know, because this process occurs sometimes over long periods of time, it's really hard to track disruptive selection. Okay. Any questions about that? Now, sometimes sometimes evolution occurs just by chance. And when we have evolution by chance, this is what we call genetic drift. Okay? So genetic drift is simply evolution that occurs by chance. Now I'm going to give you a hypothetical situation here, then we're going to talk about a real world situation where genetic drift has occurred. Right? If we had a field, and in this field we have a bunch of grasshoppers, okay? Now these grasshoppers have different colors on their wings, okay? Some of these grasshoppers have blue on their wings and some have green on their wings because they have a blue and a green marker, all right? Okay. So let's say we have 20 blue-winged grasshoppers. 1, 2. And let's say we have 20 green-winged grasshoppers again. So there's the same number to begin with. Now these grasshoppers are just randomly distributed through the field, right? And there's really no part of our field from a theoretical standpoint that's better than any other part of the field. Does that kind of make sense? What would happen if a flood came through this field and wiped the grasshoppers out? So let's say our flood came through and wiped the grasshoppers out. This is kind of the trail of the flood here, okay? All of those grasshoppers were wiped out. Would that cause evolution to occur?
Yeah.
Yeah, in the next generation there should be what? More blue-winged grasshoppers. Okay. Now it's not because the blue-winged grasshoppers are any smarter. It's not because they have any trait that makes them better. It's just what? They happen to be in the right place at the right time. Does that make sense? And that's what genetic drift is. It's just kind of evolution by chance. One place that genetic drift has been studied quite extensively is on a mountain in Washington called Mount St. Helens. You've probably heard of Mount St. Helens before. It's an active volcano. Most volcanoes, okay, what they do is they typically blow out of the top of the volcano, right? When Mount St. Helens blew in the 80s, instead of blowing out the top of the volcano, what happened was a piece of the volcano was blown out and the volcano blew out kind of sideways on the top of the volcano, right? And what happened was all of the organisms on this side of the mountain were killed. All of the elk, all of the mice, all of the ground squirrels, okay? Everything was obliterated on that one side of the mountain. Now, was it because they were stupid animals? Well, it just happens they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so now what they've actually found is that by studying this situation is that the animals around Mount St. Helens are much different than animals in very similar environments, just a mountain range away kind of a thing. And it's due to genetic drift or evolution by chance. Okay. Another example where we think genetic drift has occurred is in the Grand Canyon. On either side of the Grand Canyon there are two species of squirrels. One's found on one side of the Grand Canyon, the other one's found on the other side. One's called the Kaibab squirrel. It's found on the north rim. And what we think happened is they are somewhat similar, but actually now they're what we would consider to be different species. Okay. What we think happened was they were probably one species, and then when the Colorado started to cut down through the Grand Canyon, it separated the squirrels on either side of the Colorado River. They couldn't get across the Colorado to crossbreed. And so it just so happened that the squirrels were different that happened to be caught on either side of the river when it cut through the Grand Canyon long, long ago. Okay. Any questions about that? Any questions about genetic drift? Okay, so sometimes evolution occurs just simply by chance. Any questions about evolution before we kind of move on to the next topic? Yeah.
How do you determine the difference between like genetic drift and the disruptive evolution, or
Well, disruptive selection, what's happening is organisms are being selected against because of some trait. Genetic drift, there's no trait that's being selected for or against, it's just simply by chance. Okay. Any other questions about that? Okay. Well, we've been talking about, at least I've introduced this term a number of times, and that's the term of a species. So we're going to talk a little bit about the taxonomical hierarchy, probably on Monday. What I want to introduce today is the idea of what is a species, okay? Most of you have heard that term before, right? You've heard of the Endangered Species Act, which is an act of Congress, okay? So what is a species? What makes species different? You can actually see the one definition here. The answer is it's not so easy to tell the difference between species. And all scientists don't follow the same rules or use the same definitions when we're talking about species. All right? Many scientists actually don't have a really good definition or a well-defined definition for species. Probably the most commonly used definition for a species is the one that I have listed here as the number one. They're a group of organisms capable of breeding with one another, and they can produce fertile, viable offspring. Okay. So if organisms can mate and produce, what does viable mean? It survives. Okay. Now what does fertile mean? That they can reproduce. So if they can produce offspring that can also reproduce, then they should probably be considered the same species. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Does that bring up the idea then that people who can't have children aren't part of our species?
No. Because they have the potential to. Okay. Theoretically speaking. Okay. But what it does bring up is it brings up some really interesting, I guess you could say, conundrums. Okay. For example, well, let me ask this question. According to this definition, those of you that know about this, answer the question. If a horse and a jackass cross, okay, are they the same species of horse and jackass? No. Why? Do they have a viable offspring?
Yes.
Yeah, they do, right? It's called a what? A mule. Is the mule fertile?
No.
So according to our definition, horses and jackasses would be what? Separate species. Does that make sense? Okay. What about...
Then the mule not a species.
What's that?
So then the mule, is that not a species?
A mule is just a nothing. Because it's infertile. Okay. Same thing is true with like tigers and lions. Most of you have seen a liger before, or a stuffed liger. It's an infertile, viable offspring. Can organisms cross and not be able to produce a viable offspring?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. In other words, if the offspring gets too large and the mother dies or something, it may be inviable. Okay. Or maybe the genes don't match up. Let me ask you a really interesting question. Yeah.
Like with the mule, what happened to cause? Have you heard about Blue Moon? There were two mules that bred and
that were fertile. Yeah, we'll talk about that. That sometimes will happen. And we'll talk about that situation here. Maybe not today, but we'll get to that. Every once in a while, even when you have typically infertile offspring, it will, for some reason, have fertile offspring every so often. This is kind of interesting. Are zebras and horses separate species? Most of you, just off the top of your head, would probably say what? Obviously, you know, there's something up because I'm asking a question, right? But you'd say what? They're probably separate species, right? Yeah. But actually, they can cross-produce viable fertile offspring. Okay.
Those guys in Wales, isn't that an example? They've got a zebra up there.
I don't know. I haven't seen that. Oh. Is the one half? Usually, when they cross, the front half is like it's not striped. And the back half is striped. And then if you cross them again with a horse, you'll get an offspring that doesn't have any stripes at all, which indicates that the stripes of zebras are probably what type of a characteristic, a recessive characteristic. Yeah.
So if you take, like, what you're saying, the horse and the zebra, and then you take the young from that, and if you get another one, are they going to have the same characteristics as if you would have taken a zebra and a horse, or are the characteristics going to change again?
You mean the second generation? They're going to change. Okay. Depends on who you breed them with. If you back cross them with a zebra, if you breed them together,
yeah,
they'll look more like a horse. Fewer stripes.
Like, could you get, like, even on, like, the third generation, could you get the stripes back if you made it with another zebra, or would it just stay?
Theoretically, you could. Okay. Let me ask you a question. Are you a separate species from the chimpanzee? How do you know?
It just sounds better to say.
Could we cross and produce viable fertile offspring? Yeah.
Didn't somebody try to do that in World War II? Didn't they artificially inseminate a female with a chimpanzee?
Yeah, they've actually tried this. Okay. In Sweden, the government found out though and made them terminate the pregnancy. But at the time, the fetus was viable. So maybe we are not different from. Maybe we're not a separate species from chimpanzees, according to our definition. Now, what's really kind of frustrating and interesting, I guess, at the same time, is we have things such as the Endangered Species Act. And I've worked with a number of endangered species throughout my career, mostly plants, but some animals as well. And what's really interesting is that some of the species don't fit this definition of species, okay? And this is probably the most loose definition of species that is out there. What we're actually doing many times, we're spending millions of dollars saving a subspecies, okay? And that's fine if we want to do that, but we ought to at least call it the Endangered Subspecies Act, right? Okay. Many times in organisms, we use the term subspecies just to describe races. Now, that's not politically correct to do that with humans, but if we were to apply the same terminology to humans that we do to other organisms, every race of human would actually be considered a different subspecies. Okay. Let me give you a couple of examples of kind of saving endangered subspecies instead of endangered species. Many of you ever heard of the spotted owl, northern spotted owl, before? If you're from Oregon or Washington, you've probably heard of them because it put a lot of people out of work. The northern spotted owl was thought to be endangered. We thought that it was endangered. It only lives in old growth forests, and so what they did was people sued the federal government and logging companies, and basically it shut down the logging industry in the Northwest. Okay, put a lot of people out of jobs. Really caused a lot of economic havoc up there. What's interesting is the spotted owl is not a separate species. It's actually a subspecies. There's another species of owl called the Mexican spotted owl. It lives a little bit further south typically. But you can cross the two birds and they produce viable fertile offspring. Okay. And so that's something that you kind of need to think about when you're thinking about the Endangered Species Act. Do we really need to save every organism that's just a little bit different? It's maybe just different subspecies or what we call a different ecotype. Or can we just look at species in general? Does that make sense to everybody? I've actually worked with this quite a bit with plants. You can take almost any species of plant that you find throughout the state of Utah, and what you'll find is that in different parts of Utah, these species of plants have very different characteristics. So you could theoretically argue that in some places, these plants are slightly endangered, right? Different ecotypes or different, they have a little bit different phenotype. And so theoretically, we could argue to save every one of those species. Does that make sense? And if you do that, you run into some big problems. And here's another thing that a lot of people don't understand about endangered species. In Utah, well, throughout the world, most endangered species have always been endangered, and they will always be endangered no matter what we do. Did you know that? Does that surprise some of you? Most species that are endangered not because of humans, but because they've always been endangered. Right? For example, one place where we have endangered species around here is in a place called the Arapian Mountain Range. If you guys go down to Nine Mile Reservoir, okay, there's a kind of some white hills that run from about Nine Mile Reservoir, just outside of Sterling, down to Salina. Okay, it's called the Arapian Range. In that range of mountains, we have a few threatened and endangered species. The species that are threatened and endangered in the Arapian Range have always been threatened and endangered. Because what happened were those plants actually evolved to live in this environment that this is about the only place in the world that you find the same type of soils, the same type of temperature, is just between a short area between Sterling, essentially, and Salina. Does that make sense? So those plants evolved to live in that specialized environment. And since that specialized environment isn't very large, by definition, they are always going to be what? Threatened and endangered. Does that make sense?
What are the endangered species that
there? There's actually a couple of them. One is a rainbow paintbrush. There's about three different species of astragalus, a species of penstemon. But they're always going to be endangered. We find that throughout Utah. There are little pockets of where we have endangered species. One's up in Duchesne County, and there's a geological formation that surfaces there that's found nowhere else in the world. And sure enough, there's plants that inhabit there that are different from any other plants in the world. Okay, which shouldn't be too surprising, right? Now, not all scientists actually use this definition of a species. Another definition of a species is the following: organisms that share a common gene pool. Now, this definition of a species is actually a little bit broader than the previous definition. Okay? Let me give you an example of where this might occur. This is a true example, but I'm going to over-exaggerate it. Okay? Okay, here's the United States. Here's Baja California over here, great state of Texas, right? And Florida. If you ever lived in Texas, they always call it the great state of Texas. It's just Texas. But in the United States, we have some flies. On the West Coast, we have these flies that are very small. On the East Coast, we have some rather large flies, okay? If you put these flies together, they cannot cross. They cannot mate. So according to our definition, we would say that they're what? They're different species, right? They can't even cross because of their size. However, in the Intermountain, where we live, there's a little bit larger fly, and then we get a little bit larger fly in the Great Plains, a little bit larger fly in kind of the Mideast. What happens is this fly can mate with this fly and produce viable fertile offspring. So we would say that they're what? Same species, according to our first definition. This fly can mate with this fly and produce viable fertile offspring. So we would say that they're what? Same species. This fly, however, cannot mate with that fly and produce viable fertile offspring. Therefore, according to our first definition, we would say what? Separate species. Can you see the problem here? In other words, we're saying this one and this one are the same species, and this one and this one are the same species, but this one and this one are not the same species. So from what this definition is saying is that theoretically, this population here can pass genes all the way across the United States. It might take a few generations, but theoretically you can get genes from this population into this population over here. In other words, they share a common gene pool. Any questions about that? Okay, so that's our second definition of species. On Monday, we are going to talk about prezygotic and postzygotic isolation mechanisms that make up speciation. Just